Welcome to Red Ice Radio. The website is redicecreations.com. My name is Henrik Palmgren, and this is a special transmission. We have an extra treat for you today and a very important subject matter. We have MEP, that's Member of the European Parliament, Nigel Farage, with us on the line for a special interview on the state of the EU and the Lisbon Treaty. I just want to mention here that Nigel is one of the founding fathers of UKIP, the UK Independence Party, and is one of the only dissident voices in the European Parliament. Understandably, he's very busy, and we only have about 30 minutes with Nigel today, and I want to squeeze in as much as possible to help spread the word about the state of the EU and the extremely important upcoming Irish vote on the Lisbon Treaty. So let's dive into it right away here. Nigel Farage, thank you very much for coming on the program with us here.
Not at all.
Okay, so let's go into it. The Lisbon Treaty, the EU constitution, pretty much revamped and renamed to a treaty. How have the leaders of the European Union managed to get this through without asking the people of the European Union what they think? And what does this say about the current state of the EU, you think?
Well, they've done it by deception. I mean, it was perfectly clear that when the French voted no, they killed it, and when the Dutch voted no, they buried it, and that should have been the end of the whole project. And what they did was they got rid of the dreaded C word. We can't call it a constitution, we'll just call it a treaty. Of course, the reality was that virtually every single thing that had been in the constitution was in the Lisbon Treaty. And they did this, and they rammed it through their own national parliaments in France and in Britain and in Sweden and everywhere else, without giving people the opportunity to express an opinion in a referendum. And I think the whole thing was appalling, frankly. The only country in which they couldn't avoid it was Ireland, who had the referendum. And, you know, before the official result had even been announced, there was Manuel Barroso, the president of the European Commission, saying that the Irish must not stop this treaty. And my view is that what the European Union has shown itself to be through these three rejections, it's shown itself to be an organization that is now so extreme, that is now so nationalistic, that it doesn't even care whether it's taking the people with it. It doesn't give a damn for the basic principles of democracy. They have decided that we're going to have a European state, and that's the end of it. And frankly, to me, history shows us that this is very, very difficult indeed, that you cannot impose a new nationality, you cannot impose a new state upon peoples without their consent, and that the modern European Union does not have the consent of the European peoples.
That's right. And again here, the Irish are going to have a vote again now then, October 2nd, if I'm not mistaken. If we're outside Ireland and our country, as you said, already has ratified this constitution that they call a treaty, is there anything we can do to help to stop this?
Well, you can cross your fingers.
Right. Oh, God.
You can cross your fingers.
Yeah.
And I'm quite sure that there'll be various no campaigns springing up in the next few weeks. And if one or two people from Sweden went across and lent them a hand, I'm sure they'd appreciate it.
Yeah.
I mean, really, you know, when the Irish vote, they're not just voting on the future of democratic accountability in Ireland, they're voting on the future of democratic accountability for 26 other countries as well. So
yes,
this is a very, very important referendum indeed.
Do you have any suggestions to how we can help provide the right information to the Irish people before the election in order to kind of help them make the right decision here?
I mean, This decision, of course, is up to the no campaigners in Ireland as to how they want to play it. But one of my suggestions to them would be to get representatives from as many European countries as possible to turn up in Ireland and to make the point that this is really an historic event and battle, and that they're voting for all of us, and they must not feel that somehow they're isolated and on their own.
What do you think the Lisbon Treaty will mean to us if it indeed is implemented?
Well, what it means, it marks not just a further transfer of power and potential power to the European Union, it actually changes the European Union itself. I mean, up until now, it's been a treaty-based organization, and its legitimacy was because the member states effectively lent their authority to the European Union. What this treaty does, or constitution as we really should call it, even if they won't use the word, we should.
Yes.
What it actually does is legally, it changes the European Union into an entity in its own right, into a state, effectively, that is able to sign its own treaties, into an organization that, within a few years, will have complete control over areas like policing, over areas like prison sentencing, you know, areas that traditionally the European Union have not been able to touch before. And it also sets up a situation whereby it'll be very difficult, nigh impossible in future, to have proper intergovernmental conferences, to have the prospect of any referendums at all, because the enabling clause within this treaty allows the heads of government, in secret, to cede to the European Union any ability to make decisions that they choose in that room. So it really marks a departure from a time when each treaty had months and months of conferences of governments and then, in some cases, referendums. And it sweeps all that aside and allows the EU in the future to do pretty much what it wants to do.
Yeah, that's right. And I wonder if you can say something about, I'm sure you heard about the Galvin report and the kind of corruption within the EU, and especially what it seems like among the MEPs.
Well, I mean, look, you know, wherever you have remote government, you will always have the temptation to fiddle money. And I think the institutions of Brussels and Luxembourg and Strasbourg, I mean, they are remote from people. I mean, I very much doubt there are many voters in Britain or Sweden who feel closely connected to the workings of the Commission or the Parliament or the Council. I mean, the best person really to talk about this isn't me, but it's my colleague Marta Andreasen.
Yes.
And just quickly, for your listeners, Marta Andreasen, a Spanish citizen, became the European Union's chief accountant back in 1999, and so she was responsible overall for a budget of 100 billion euros a year, so a very responsible and highly paid job. And within 3 years, she quit the post because there was no attempt made to reform the system. She described the whole thing as being an open invitation to fraud. And we have this extraordinary situation where the auditors for the European Union budget have now, for the last 14 years in a row, failed to give a clean bill of health to the European Union's accounts. So this is real money.
Yeah.
You know, we're now well over 100 billion euros a year in terms of the budget. It's money that, you know, hardworking taxpayers are pouring into these coffers, and there appears to be just no accountability whatsoever. So whichever way you look at this, I mean, we started off this interview talking about the democratic side of it and how they just ignored the referendums and how disgraceful that is, and we can move on to the financial side of it and see that there's no responsibility there either.
That's right, and we are communicating with Marta Andreasen, by the way, and we'll have her on the program at the end of August, so thank you for mentioning that. And okay, so I want to ask you, what do you think about Barroso's choice of people to lead the commission? I think you talked about this.
Well, it struck me as being very funny that you know, in 1999, the entire commission had been forced to stand down in disgrace. They'd been replaced by another commission who'd shown themselves to be incapable of reforming or changing things at all. And then in 2004, Mr. Barroso pops up and tells the world, look, I've got this wonderful team of people. And the one particular example that I referred to at the time and that I continue to refer to is the fact that the French nominee, Mr. Barreau, had himself, in the year 2000, been convicted in a French court of embezzlement, given an 8-month suspended prison sentence, and barred from public office. Mm. And he now is the commissioner in charge of criminal justice. So we have a foreign criminal deciding what foreign criminals may or may not live in Britain. I mean, the whole thing, you simply couldn't make it up.
Yeah, that's right. It's just incredible. And, you know, I want to ask you also about this idea that the anthem and flag seem to be used regardless kind of the promise that they made that this would not be used. What can you say about that?
Well, yeah. We talked earlier about the European Constitution becoming the Lisbon Treaty and getting rid of the dreaded C word. But the other big promise we were made is, this new treaty has nothing to do with the state because the symbols of state, namely the flag and the anthem, have been dropped. Well, I can assure everybody listening that when the European Parliament new session opened on July the 14th, the first thing that happened was they played the anthem, and everybody stood up ramrod straight, apart from me, of course, who sat there with my arms crossed, muttering very loudly, I thought you dropped all this. So, you know, once again, it's yet another deception. You know, what is happening here? What is happening here is individual nation states are having taken from them their ability to vote for people and to fire people who make their laws and run their country, and that is being taken away and being replaced by a new form of government based in Brussels, a form of government that is not directly accountable to the voters.
Do you think that they're trying to kind of create a new European identity as well, the Euro-nationals, as you refer to them, this idea of Europeanism, right?
Yes, I mean, they would like to think that in years to come, we'll say we're Europeans first and we're British second or we're Swedish second or whatever it is, and that our identity will be a European identity and there'll be a European football team and if there was a crisis, we'd all put military uniforms on and go out to fight for Europe. And that's what they'd like to impose. The evidence, actually, is that however hard they try and however much money they spend in our schools and universities convincing us of our European identity, that in fact we're going in the opposite direction and that people are beginning to feel much more identity with their own nationality and in some cases with their own region. So yes, it's an aspiration of theirs, but like so much else with this union, it's not much more than a pipe dream, really.
Tony Blair as a potential future president of the European Union. Any thoughts?
Well, many people think that Tony Blair, if he became president of the European Union, somehow the British would suddenly overnight fall in love with the whole thing. I take the opposite view. I think that if Blair becomes the president, if Lisbon is ratified, I think people will take the view here overwhelmingly that this was a reward, selling out British democracy, but picking up the top job himself. And I would have thought that a Blair presidency would make the EU even more unpopular in Britain. So in that particular regard, I'm not necessarily opposed to it.
I want to ask you a little bit about this idea about EU as a kind of future Soviet state again. This is an undemocratic process that we see now in the EU, and there are several people, former Soviet dissidents that have defected, so to speak, that have warned about this. Is this something that you see as well?
Well, yeah, there's a very, very famous guy called Vladimir Bukovsky.
Yes.
Who for 12 years was in and out of mental institutions in the Soviet Union and spent time in the Gulag. And he was swapped for a prisoner and came to Britain in the 70s. And one of the things that Vladimir talks about is the fact that there are some strong similarities between that union and this union. The idea that you can have centralized control, the idea that you can plan 5, 10, 15, 20 years ahead, the sort of famous Soviet five-year plans, and the idea that you can't tolerate any criticism of the system at all, and that you make sure that at no stage do voters have any real power. These are similarities. And what we've got here, yes, we have a European Parliament, but the government of Europe is the European Commission. These are unelected, appointed, professional career politicians, and these are the people making decisions that affect every business and affect the life of every single person. And I really do think, I'm not going to say that it will become just like Soviet Russia, because that wouldn't be sensible. Mm. We're living in different times. But I think the tendency to be centralized, to be bureaucratic, to technologically fall behind, and to treat democracy with contempt, I think they are very similar and very common features.
I want to ask you a little bit about Barroso as well. Do you think that he has some kind of more socialist ideas, considering that back in, I think it was 1976, he was actually a Maoist student leader? Do you think that he's brought some of that with him into the position that he now holds?
I don't get terribly hung up on whether people are socialists or not. What I get hung up about is, are they statists and are they European statists? And Barroso is a statist. He wants the EU to do more and more and more. He believes that more and more legislation somehow makes the world a better and more prosperous place. I do not take that view. I think we already have far too much legislation. And I also, personally, can never, ever have any regard for Barroso as a person because of the contemptuous way on that particular afternoon that he dealt with the Irish no result, just brushing it aside and saying, effectively, the Irish don't matter. We're going to continue anyway. So this man has total contempt for the concept of parliamentary democracy, and I will not be voting for him when we vote in September for his reappointment. I shall vote against and do so very firmly.
And I think that Valéry Giscard d'Estaing, who was originally kind of drawing up the constitution, also said something about this in the French magazine Le Monde, that pretty much that we can avoid what the you know, Irish people said and actually run it through anyway, right?
Oh yeah. Well, I mean, in effect, they've been doing that for years. I mean, even under the existing treaties, there are various articles that do allow the European Commission to have an extraordinary degree of power. But I think the important thing about the Irish vote, it's about symbolism. It's about symbolism. It's about showing once again that this model of Europe is being imposed upon people against their wills, and that the gap that exists between the governors and the governed is now a gaping chasm. And at some point, you know, because nature abhors a vacuum, at some point that vacuum is going to be filled. And to me, the important thing is that we fill that vacuum with people who are committed to free and fair referendums, are committed to democracy, and that we don't get the vacuum filled by extreme nationalism, because that, to me, is one of the great dangers. You know, imposing a European statehood upon people could well, in many countries, lead to a serious rise in extremist politics, and I don't want to see that at all.
Yeah, yeah. So you are on the ground floor, so to speak. I want to ask you just a little bit, if you can share with us what it is like. How much documentation do you go through? Do you manage to keep up with all the new laws that are passed? Do you have time to read everything?
No. I mean, you know, let me be absolutely honest with you. When I go into that chamber to vote, 90% of the things I vote on, I haven't got a clue what they are.
Oh, really?
You know, I mean, and it could be, of course, that I am particularly stupid, and it could be that I'm surrounded by 500 people, all of whom have the brains of Albert Einstein, and have been up all night reading thousands of pages of documents. I suspect that I'm not especially stupid, and I'm pretty certain that, in fact, there aren't many Albert Einsteins sitting in the European Parliament. I mean, you know, we have days there when we vote on up to 1,000 amendments.
Oh, God.
There is nobody in this world who could understand all of those things. And so we have a system where each MEP, by their own secretariat, are given a voting list, and if it's vote number 58 and you're told to abstain, you just abstain. It is an appalling system, but it is a symptom. It's a symptom of a European Union that never-endingly spews out, you might say, an absolutely massive, massive volume of laws. And we're now in a position where 75% on average of the laws that are made in each of our member states are not made by our own governments in London or Stockholm, but are made by the institutions of the European Union.
Yeah.
And this is something that I think people have been slow to recognize, but they're beginning to wake up to. And the worst aspect of it is this. If any law becomes a European law, there is nothing we, the voters, can do at any subsequent general election in our country to change that law. And that, to me, is the fundamental betrayal of the concept of democracy within a nation state.
Is there anyone who's kind of more of an ally with you, so to speak? I'm thinking of the Danish MEP, Jens Peter Bonde, for instance.
Well, I mean, I sat with Bonde for the first 10 years of my time in the European Parliament. And Bonde and I sat next to each other, and we were co-presidents of the Independence and Democracy Group in the last Parliament. And I am keen to work with as many MEPs who believe these issues should be decided by the people and not decided by career politicians as is possible. We have a new group in this European Parliament. Last time round, of course, we had the Journalisten people with
yeah,
us.
Yeah, that's right.
Who have not come back to the Parliament, which I'm sad about, because they were very conscientious and very diligent people with some very good and very sound principles. But we've got a new group in this Parliament, and it's called the Europe of Freedom and Democracy, and we're there as a registered group. We're the only official voice of opposition within that European Parliament, and we intend to do our job.
Oh, brilliant. Is there anything people can do to help and support that in any way?
I think the important thing is to look at what we're saying, look at what we're doing, and to let your own career politicians know that you are unhappy with this. And whether that's by email, or whether that's by letter, or whether that's by telephone call, I don't mind how you do it. But if you feel on these issues the way that we feel about this, let your politicians know that you're not prepared to go on accepting this without a referendum. Because, I mean, equally, you know, what happened in your country is every bit as disgraceful as what happened here at Westminster.
Yes, absolutely. And I wonder if there's anything you can say about Sarkozy and his way of meddling in his own kind of business and the EU and so forth. What do you think about him?
Well, he's an extraordinary bloke. And on a personal level, I quite like him because he's full of energy and fun and vigour. Even if he did have a slight collapse last week whilst out jogging, but you know, you've got to admire the guy. He does bring a certain vitality to politics, which very often is missing. However, he's a person of great contradictions. You know, what he says one day appears to be contradicted directly by what he says the next day. But sometimes French national interests seem to matter rather more than European interests. But overall, he got that treaty through without giving the French a second referendum. He is, I'm afraid, despite his rather endearing qualities, he is a part of the problem and not a part of the solution.
Well, someone recently said, I think, in an article that he's another Napoleon in a suit. Is he a little dictator, do you think?
Well, he's certainly got a very strong personality, and he's certainly somewhat mercurial. Yes, there are some slight Napoleonic tendencies there, I think.
All right. Is there anything you can say to us, the Swedish audience here, in regards to, I think, the parrot to Barroso sitting on his right side all the time, Margot Wallström, right?
Oh, dear. Yeah. I don't want to be insulting.
You can on this program.
towards one of your countrymen.
No worries.
It's not a very polite thing to do. Margot Wallström, I mean, frankly, her behavior over the last 5 years has been abysmal. You know, she talks in Eurospeak, in bureaucratic terms. She clearly doesn't understand what ordinary people are about. And I did offer an invitation to Margot a few years ago. I said to her that she'd be very welcome to come to my village pub in England on a Sunday lunchtime, where she could actually meet some real people and find out what they thought about the world. And I also offered, in a spirit of friendly cooperation, that I'd take her to a cricket match so she could understand the English game of cricket. But sadly, she hasn't taken me up on either of those things. She's somebody who lives inside the bureaucratic bubble, and she constantly, you know, whenever people vote no or whatever they say in referendums, she always says, well, of course, what the people really meant was that they want more Europe. No, Margot, you're not listening, are you? So, she's perfectly pleasant when you meet her on a one-to-one basis. Mm. And I met her the night of the Irish referendum. I was going in to do a BBC interview, and she was on before me. And as I walked into the studio, she was there with her press man. And I said, oh, hello, good evening, Margot. I said, yet another no vote that you intend to ignore, isn't it? And she sort of blushed slightly. No, she is just a part of that system, earning a very big salary, enjoying a very good lifestyle, but not even comprehending the need of ordinary voters.
Do you think that it's the money who actually drives them, or do you think that they really are into this European ideology, so to speak?
I think it's both. I think some of them believe in the European project, and that is their religion, if you like. For others, it's a highly paid job with the best pension scheme the world's yet invented for anybody, with a guarantee that effectively you can't ever be sacked. So in terms of a career move, for the sort of professional bureaucrat or professional politician, it is a very, very good thing to do. I can't tell you which Margot is. Perhaps she's a bit of both.
How about all the allowances fraud? The German TV station had one little newscast on this issue, where it seems that a lot of MEPs are getting a lot of money out of this. They even have transitional allowances, which means that they get a lot of money after their term and so forth. What's going on there? Can that be stopped?
Well, I mean, there are one or two reforms that are coming into the travel expenditure, etc. And I think the real story to flag up is there is now a common salary for MEPs of €7,000 a month, right? Now, that figure may not appear to be very shocking for you or very shocking for us, But imagine if you come from Bulgaria or Romania, where the average salary is 160 euros a month, and you're now getting 7,000 euros a month. Jeez. I mean, these are, to the Eastern European politicians, these are riches beyond the dreams of avarice. What an extraordinary system has been created. And isn't it interesting that six of the commissioners that we currently have were, in the old days, communists working for the Soviet government.
Yes.
And they've made the transition into being European commissioners. And that tells me as much as I need to know about the type of people governing us.
Yeah. So I have a few more questions for you here. The future of the EU, is there any way out of this? Can nations actually go out of the EU? Do you know this?
Of course they can. The Lisbon Treaty makes it more difficult because for the first time ever, it codifies the means by which a country can leave, saying that you have to state the intention to leave, and there's then going to be a two-year cooling off and negotiating period. Personally, I'm going to refuse to respect the legitimacy of that. I won't respect this treaty because it's been pushed upon us by a government that had promised us a referendum on it. You can have all sorts of legal arguments about these things, but at the end of the day, if public opinion in your country or my country reaches tidal wave proportions, then it doesn't matter what the rule book says, it's public will that will out. And I believe this will happen. I can't tell you whether it's going to be next year, whether it's going to take 10 years, but I'm utterly convinced that the project does not have consent. I'm utterly convinced that the economic and social model that they're putting together isn't working. And I'm utterly convinced that all of us want to live in a Europe where we live in our own countries, govern ourselves, and try and be good next door neighbors to each other, not live as part of a new unified militarized state.
The Euro, Sweden and Britain are currently not members of the Monetary Union yet. Do you expect them to join soon? Will they ram this through as well?
I see no prospect of Britain joining the Euro. I can't comment intelligently on Swedish public opinion on this particular issue, but I think it highly unlikely that countries like Greece and Portugal and Spain and Ireland will be members of the Euro in 5 years from now, perhaps even 2 years from now. You know, they just don't fit, not to mention the Italians, who are finding it very, very difficult. I think it's more likely that countries will leave the Euro than countries like Britain and Sweden will join it.
Okay, so in closing here then, what can people do if they want to help you or anyone else to support you in your efforts? Or is there anything other kind of closing thoughts you have before us, before we let you go?
You just make sure that in elections, whether they're local elections, whether they're national elections, whether they're European elections, you just make sure that you do not vote for politicians, whether they're left, center, or right, because frankly that's irrelevant compared with the bigger question. Do not vote for politicians that will continue to push you further into this project without giving you your say. And in the intervening time between elections, let them know how you feel. Remember, these people need votes to keep their jobs. The best way to get them to change, the best way to get them to give in and give you the chance in referendums to have your say is to frighten the life out of them.
Nigel Farage, thank you very much for your time, and Godspeed to the people behind you, you know.
Thank you.
All right, thank you very much for tuning in. Spread this program and let people know what's going on. Nigel is someone who is on the inside of the European system of government. Check out ukip.org or youtube.com/Europarl for European Parliament. youtube.com/Europarl for much more information. And of course, our website, redicecreations.com. Join our member section if you want to get access to more thought-provoking radio, video, films, and webcasts that all questions the global way politics is being run at this time and the other surrounding subjects that are of interest and importance. Check out our related program with David Icke on this issue as well. It's now available on our website, redicecreations.com, and our upcoming program with Martha Andreasen that Nigel mentioned during this program. My name is Henrik. My thanks to Fredrik and Elizabeth. We'll be back soon. Take good care, and we'll see you later.
President, Mr. Barroso says, I think my team is of high quality. Well, let's conduct a human audit. Now, I'm mindful that audits aren't very popular in the European Commission, and that auditors, if they do their job properly, get fired, but nonetheless, here goes. From France, we have Mr. Jacques Barrot. He'll take on transport. In 2000, he received an 8-month suspended jail sentence for his involvement in an embezzlement case and was banned from holding public office for 2 years. From Hungary, we have Mr. Kovács. He'll take on taxation. For many years, a communist apparatchik, a friend of Mr. Kadhafi, the dictator there, and an outspoken opponent of the values that we hold dear in the West. His new empire will produce taxation policy, and he'll look after the customs union from Cork across to Vilnius. Are the EPP and British Conservatives really going to vote for that? From Estonia, we have Mr. Kallas. For 20 years, a Soviet party apparatchik, until his newly acquired taste for capitalism got him into some trouble. Though, to be fair, he was acquitted of abuse and fraud, but convicted for providing false information, and he's going to be in charge of the anti-fraud drive. I mean, you couldn't make it up. From the UK, we've got Peter Mandelson. He'll take on the trade portfolio. He, of course, twice was removed from the British government, yet, to be fair, he's one of the more competent ones. From the Netherlands, we've got Nelly Kroes. She'll take on competition. She's accused of lying to the European Parliament. Now, these may only be allegations, but they're made by Mr. Van Buitenen, and I think should be listened to. Ask yourself a question. Would you buy a used car from this commission? I mean, the answer simply must be no. But even if they were competent, even if this was a high-quality commission, and sorry, Mr. Barroso, but I don't think it is, even if it was a high-quality commission, we would still vote no on the political principle that it's the commission that is the guardian of the treaties, that it's the commission that is the motor for integration, that it's the commission that initiates the legislation that is damaging our businesses across Europe so badly. It is the commission that is the embodiment of all that is worst in this European Union. It is the commission that is the government of Europe and is not directly accountable to anybody. And please, when you vote, take note that 20 of these commissioners have already said that they intend to attempt to implement the Constitution even before it's been ratified by member states' governments. In the face of such breathtaking arrogance, nobody in the Independence and Democracy Group will vote for this commission. Thank you.